You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. As day breaks on Thursday, thousands of people representing many different indigenous nations and tribes will be gathering on Alcatraz. 52 years ago, a group of Native activists started an occupation of the island that would last almost 2 years.
We have a lot of history that needs to be acknowledged before this country can move forward.
And just a few days ago, Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland visited the island and did some of that acknowledging. But she also said, this is a new era.
Many of us are the descendants of people who endured horrific brutality at the hands of those who oppressed us. I am here. We are here. And we're not going anywhere. We're in a new era.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic. At the new industries building on Alcatraz Island, where inmates used to do laundry for the U.S. Navy, Native activists and allies marked the 52nd anniversary last Saturday of the beginning of the occupation of Alcatraz. You're hearing Greg Castro, he's the cultural director of the Association of Ramaytush Ohlone, singing a Rumson Ohlone fog song.
I was here in the Bay Area as a young child, sort of young, 13 years old, and my mother was starting the process of decolonizing, opening up my mind. And that summer I read Vine Deloria's Custer Died for Your Sins, and then a few months later, Heroes took over Alcatraz.
On November 20th, 1969, 80 indigenous people landed on the island saying they were exercising a right established in the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. The treaty said unused federal lands could be claimed by Native Americans. This arrival marked the beginning of what would become a 19-month occupation, which in turn would spark a national movement for indigenous rights, the Red Power Movement. The events leading up to the occupation were a continuation of generations of racist, violently oppressive policies targeting Native American people. In 1953, Congress passed the Termination Policy, ending federal recognition of many tribes and calling for their lands to be sold. In 1956, the Relocation Act encouraged Native Americans to relocate to cities to find work. It's just part of the context for the occupation, as Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland pointed out on Saturday. She had made a special appearance on Alcatraz, addressing media and indigenous organizers.
Gwatsi Helpa, greetings everyone. Duhinome Itzakiwitza Shui Mihanu. I'm honored to speak today from Alcatraz Island. Like many of the public lands in the care of the Department of the Interior, these lands tell a story, and you can feel it. Some may think Alcatraz Island as a place that movies and novels have described where prisoners were kept in cells and tried to escape. But for me and for many indigenous people, this land tells another story. In November of 1969, I was almost 9 years old. I didn't understand it then, but my very existence as a Native child was in some ways an act of defiance against historic policies to exterminate indigenous cultures, traditions, languages, and essentially us as a group of people. We are the descendants of ancestors who lived in tune with nature, practiced sustainability, and thrived on this continent long before the colonization of North America. Many of us are the descendants of people who endured horrific brutality at the hands of those who oppressed us. We are the descendants of grandparents, aunts, uncles, and parents who were stolen from their homes and from their families so that their cultures, traditions, and languages could be wiped away from their memories. 52 years ago, the situation was dire. The federal government had walked away from their promises to help indigenous people who were forced to relocate to urban areas. Federal agencies refused to abide by basic consultation standards, and many Native communities had lost large swaths of their lands. When Indigenous people are separated from their homelands, from our traditions, and from our people, the impacts are more than physical. They're spiritual. They manifest deep in our bodies, in our hearts, and have lasting intergenerational consequences. I remember reading countless stories of young Indigenous mothers who couldn't get housing or food for their children, Indigenous students facing discrimination at school, and terrible abuse of Indigenous people on the streets of many American cities. It harkens back to the memories of other kids making fun of my braids or my dark skin when I was a little girl. I never told my mother about these things. I didn't know it then. But I felt ashamed. So many of us did. And we didn't have the words to describe it. It's a feeling that tears at our souls and is in direct opposition to who we are as people. We cultivate community. We care for our environment. We help each other. We crave connection to our ancestors. We love the earth. The occupation of Alcatraz Island by Indigenous people in 1969 was more than a call for action. It was a cry for a sense of community and the lifeways that were stolen from us. Alcatraz was born out of desperation. Out of this, we gained a sense of community and visibility in the eyes of the federal government. But more than that, our Indigenous identities were somehow restored. Many people romanticize the occupation of Alcatraz, but we cannot overlook the hardships that families endured over those 2 years. But because of the sacrifices that were made in this place, we no longer have to act out of desperation. The fact that I'm standing here today is a testament to that fact. I am here. We are here. And we're not going anywhere. We're in a new era.
Here are some of the things that she pointed out. Last month, President Biden announced protections for Bears Ears National Monument. More recently, the Interior Department said it would take steps to protect Chaco Canyon and surrounding lands in northwestern New Mexico. The Interior Department and 16 other federal agencies have also committed to protecting tribal treaty rights and policy and regulatory processes, and there's an interagency initiative to promote the practice and development of native languages. The infrastructure bill will also make billions of dollars of investment in Indigenous communities, both into replacing old infrastructure and climate adaptations, which include relocation.
But investing in Indigenous people will not alone solve the challenges we face. We have schools and infrastructure to build. We have legacy pollution to address. We have communities that are literally being washed away by coastal erosion. And there is a racism in this country that continues to target Native people. Offensive names, mascots, and rally cries are not a thing of the past, but their time has come. And as long as I have a platform to speak from, I will stand against them. And that is why yesterday I used my authority to ensure that squaw, which is used in the names of hundreds of federal land units, is never used again.
You might remember that in September, that word was removed from a popular skiing area near Lake Tahoe for the same reason. It's now known as Palisades Tahoe.
Being here matters. No longer do Indigenous people have to occupy a site to get the attention of the government. We are at the table, and we're not giving up our seats. We have a long way to go to fully heal from the traumas created by historical oppression. I know that removing racist names, investing in broadband for tribal communities, and protecting Native languages, those won't change everything. But change, even if incremental, is still change. And our moment is now. With Indigenous voices in power, perhaps we can create the world that those who occupied the Rock envisioned, one of equity and justice. I know that I stand here on the shoulders of so many leaders who came before me. I stand here because the path that many carved ahead of me was clear, and I am very grateful for that. I intend to work with and for all Native people so that we can ensure Indigenous children have every opportunity to achieve their dreams and one day stand on my shoulders to achieve more than we can even dream of. Dawa'a. Thank you.
One of the people listening to those remarks was Dr. Lenaida Warjack, an original occupier of Alcatraz, who returned for this commemoration. The secretary had met with her and with other organizers briefly before the event.
It was amazing. Like I said, it was a tremendous honor for us, and we were really happy that she came. It says a lot for her and the people, because we don't represent the tribes, we represent the people. We're just the Indians.
Secretary Deb Haaland's appearance was limited to press and the indigenous organizers, but the rest of the commemoration would take place in a building on the island that houses an established exhibit on the occupation and the Red Power movement. And while occupiers and their descendants were speaking and musicians and dancers were performing, tourists were coming in.
What would you like them to take away from some of the remarks that you and others are going to make today and from this exhibit?
Well, we're still here, we're alive, and we have a lot of history that needs to be acknowledged before this country can move forward, because of the genocide and the taking of the children and the graveyards now that have been located, not only here but in Canada. And we want people to know that we have a culture, and it wasn't the way that the colonists projected at us. You know, it was really themselves that they were projecting, but not us. We need to stop the racism and the discrimination and start treating everybody with respect. You know, we're all people, and we have so much alike that we just need to move forward and grow up.
A few other people said similar things about having to recognize the history in order to move forward. Here's William Patrick Ryan, who was on the island for a few months at the age of 7.
The thing about understanding our history, I think a lot of racism continues to exist because it's a justification for what happened. You know, if I can continue to hate you for some reason, then I can justify what was done. So I think if people really just look at history honestly, you know, it wasn't anybody that's alive today's fault what happened in this country, you know, when Columbus landed. So nobody has to take responsibility for it personally. But please, just look at it honestly. And I think if you look at it honestly and look at yourself and say, well, it was wrong, but it wasn't my fault, I think we can get by a lot of crap. But I also think unless we know where we've been honestly, we have an honest look at history and we know where we've been, we'll never find a proper way forward, you know, to someplace that's more humane than the world we live in today. I was a child here from November of 1970 to about March of 71. I was 7 years old. This place had a big impact on me for several reasons and why it's important to me today. The apartment buildings that used to be on the side of the island where the Golden Gate is on that end, I had pneumonia and almost died in one of those buildings. My whole childhood was involved in activism. And I didn't really get to have a childhood in the normal, quote unquote, normal sense of a childhood. And so when I began to have children, I raised three boys. I kept my mouth shut in spite of what I learned in college. In spite of the awakening that I had, I kept my mouth shut because when I looked at my childhood, I decided that I didn't like it. Now they are a long way away from me. I'm by myself, and I'm going to say whatever I have to say. Yeah. And I don't care who agrees, doesn't agree. I'm just going to voice my opinion. Humanity's got some serious problems. We have three foundational problems as I see it. One is our greed, both individual and collective. And I don't think that our greed is standard equipment on the human person. I think it's a learned behavior. It provided security when we were in our infancy. As a learned behavior, I think it can be unlearned. Our next problem is the economic system we live in. From my education, capitalism has an inherent flaw. It always fails. It always ends in revolution. The third problem is the reality of our existence. We live in a finite system, and apparently, most people seem to think that we can just grow infinitely. I have a problem with that because if you watch the news, economists will say we have a healthy economy if we're growing 3% a year. Great, that's great. But tell me, how do you have infinite growth in a finite system? It's mathematically impossible. It's like saying you're going to grow a 200-foot redwood in a 6-inch pot. It's just not going to happen. I'm here today because I was here then, but more than that, to deliver this message that beyond this, and this was great, this changed everything for Indian country. It stopped the termination policy. It was the beginning of self-determination for Native Americans. It was one of the most significant things to happen to Native Americans in our history. However, I think we need to go beyond that.
A lot happened during those almost 2 years of the occupation. Families came and went with kids like William. Hundreds of people under the name Indians of All Tribes established systems of daily life. They set up kitchens, a medical clinic, and a school, even a radio station, while also marking terrible events like illnesses and even a death. The leader of the occupation, Richard Oakes, and his wife left the island after their 13-year-old daughter died falling from a stairwell. Eventually, the U.S. government cut off access to a water barge and to power, and later fires destroyed several buildings. The press coverage that had started out sympathetic turned against the occupiers. In June of 1971, federal marshals removed the 15 remaining activists. But a bigger movement had been sparked, and even the federal government reacted. President Richard Nixon ended the termination policy and signed 22 other pieces of legislation that expanded recognition of Native American sovereignty. We'll get back to the story about the occupation of Alcatraz and Native activism in just a moment. You've been listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. The annual News Match Challenge is going on right now. That means when you support our work, your donation will be matched by a pool of funds created to support local news. If you value the in-depth reporting and storytelling that we do here at the Public Press and with Civic, and you're in a position to support it, you can help keep our content paywall and ad-free with a donation. And because the Newsmatch campaign will run through the end of the year, your impact will be doubled. You can join today at sfpublicpress.org. Become a monthly supporter or give a one-time gift. And if that's not in the cards for you right now, you can still make a difference. Help more people find Civic and the Public Press. Leave us a review on your podcasting platform of choice. Share a link to a story, or just tell your friends and your family about what you're hearing. However you choose to support us, you have our sincere thanks. Let's talk some more about the occupation of Alcatraz and how activists are commemorating it and what they're working on today. In 2019, which marked the 50th anniversary of the occupation, the political messages, like "Indians welcome," that were painted on some of the island's buildings, were retouched to preserve them. The Park Service has partnered with occupiers and activists to at least keep the history of these events visible through that effort and through the exhibit. They've also shown interest in another big step. One of the main demands of the original occupiers was a cultural center and museum to be established on the island. More than half a century later, that still hasn't happened, but activists haven't abandoned the idea, and it's been inching closer to reality. Dr. Lenita Warjack's daughter, Jessica James, presented the new proposal, a refreshed version of what her mother had developed in the 70s.
Some of the activities that we plan is to have a plaque and written prayer for the island to recognize the Ohlone land. We'd also like to have Native California songs and dances for various occasions here on the island. We'd also like to have artists and storytellers to be given honorariums for sharing their stories. And we would like to be able to pay the artists for their design of the Thunderbird totem representing all nations. We'd also like to have California Native and One Native be on the Golden Gate Parks and Recreation budget that would help pay for expenses. Would also like to include travel arrangements for the planning committee to come out and do the anniversary every year. So these are some of the activities we would like funded. Also, we would like to have broadband internet here on the island, so that we could coordinate and do some live feeds and share with the public.
I caught up with her after her presentation to learn a little more. The Indians of All Tribes Planning Committee is looking for grant money from the federal government that would help them incorporate as a 501c3 nonprofit and develop a website to advance the process of developing the cultural center.
We wrote a proposal to the Secretary of Interior's office, and, you know, as being part of the planning committee, you know, we initiated that effort and that letter to go out. And then we've been working with the National Park Service to, you know, make sure that this event takes place and that our future endeavors of the cultural center takes place as well. And we're hoping that with creating a budget to get a cultural center on the island, to get some staff, to also pay for cultural projects and activities throughout the year, that's stuff that we want to make sure is included in the budget as well. You know, Alcatraz Island is the only Park Service that really promotes and encourages and acknowledges the birthplace of the Red Power Movement that took place in the early 60s.
So you wrote this letter to the Secretary of the Interior. She was here today. What has the response been from her office?
It's been pretty positive. I think she realizes and recognizes what the efforts have been, and I hope that she will continue to, you know, stand by us and help us with the cultural center implementation with the budget.
What was your conversation with her like today? What was it like to see her speak here?
It was good. She did mainly a listening session with our planning committee earlier. We told her our concerns, and she definitely acknowledged our concerns within her speech, and I think she did a phenomenal job, and I hope that, you know, she helps with getting a budget together and appropriated for this, you know, for our cultural center museum here on the island.
I was talking to someone earlier, William, I believe, who was talking about how it sometimes feels like people don't know what happened here and the significance of it. I wonder if you feel that way too, and what you would say to people who don't really know the history.
I run into a lot of people that don't know the history. And actually, this is the birthplace of the American Indian Red Power Movement, you know, back in 1969. In our contemporary history, this is when and the place of where our people, you know, took a stand and said, we have all these broken treaties that are taking place with the federal government and injustices that are taking place. You know, our people are in poverty, on reservations, and in urban areas. And, you know, they took a stand and brought our issues to the front lines here. And it was really awesome to read about, you know, the occupation in history books. But you don't learn it until you're, like, taking an American Indian Studies class or something like that to really acknowledge the significance of it. I'm just very fortunate to have a mother that always talked about it, and, you know, I grew up with knowing about it. And, you know, the education piece is huge. And I think that we need to continue educating our people and the public about the occupation, and that's what I think is so crucial about having a cultural center and museum here on the island, to provide that education for people.
Jessica's carrying forward the work that her mother did, as are many people in her generation. The descendants of occupation leader Richard Oakes showed up on Saturday for the commemoration, along with several other young people carrying on legacies of activists for Indigenous solidarity. And there's lots of work being done now.
My name is Morningstar Galley, and I'm Ojibwe Band of Pitt River Tribe. I serve as the California Tribal and Community Liaison with the International Indian Treaty Council.
In October, the Pitt River Tribe succeeded in defeating an industrial wind farm project that was threatening an environmentally and culturally important site on their lands. And in early November, PG&E returned 786 acres of ancestral lands to the tribe. The land was originally purchased by Mount Shasta Power in the early 1900s, but tribal members described that deal as using deceitful and coercive methods. Those two victories mean about 5,000 acres of land will go back to the tribe. Morningstar says that's good, but not enough.
When we say land back, it's kind of funny because people are like, you don't really mean land back. And we're like, yeah, that's exactly what we mean. So I just wanted to make sure that you folks are understanding that. Within the next few years, we will have over 5,000 acres returned to the Pitt River Tribe, but that's not enough. That the return of land to tribal stewardship, it's very historic for Pitt River Tribe and all California Indigenous peoples, but that all PG&E and publicly managed lands within our 100 square mile territory need to be returned to the Pitt River Tribe. The protection of our sacred lands, our waterways, cannot effectively happen without tribal management and stewardship. And so, as we said earlier, land back is more than a hashtag. It is the opportunity to heal our tribal nations.
And there are other ongoing efforts in the Bay Area.
Here in the San Francisco Bay Area, in the Ohlone Bay, the Indigenous Peoples 5, the IPD-5, are still fighting their case of the removal of the Sarah statue on Indigenous Peoples Day 1 year ago. And so they absolutely need our support. We need to be calling the Marin County DA and asking for the charges to be dropped. And I think that's a really important issue to highlight, because it is the Catholic Church of San Francisco, the Archdiocese of San Francisco, that has received over $5 million in restorative justice funds, and restorative justice are practices that are rooted within Indigenous values and have Indigenous roots. And, you know, modeling forgiveness, modeling what it means to heal within our communities. And so it's really difficult, you know, to try to understand that here we are in this day and age, and why is it that the Catholic Church is still providing in its actions harm, and they are still perpetuating violence against Indigenous peoples by calling for felony charges. And so they've gone as far to hold exorcisms at the area where the statue was removed. It's just pretty ridiculous at this time. And so we understand who Sarah was and what he represented to us as California Indian peoples. And we also understand that, you know, in this day and age, that those relatives that removed that Sarah statue, that they are heroes in our eyes, they are sheroes, that they should, you know, be receiving condemnation awards, that they shouldn't be punished for, you know, being on the ground and being the frontline warriors that they are.
Can you talk about Deb Haaland being here today and how significant that was for you, what your hopes are for the future of the Department of the Interior with her at the helm?
The San Francisco Indian community has been working. They've been very dedicated to having an American Indian Cultural Center. They've been very dedicated to more of the cultural awareness happening here on the island. And so this was an opportunity in terms of highlighting the Secretary of Interior's visit. As far as I know, we've never had a Secretary of Interior visit here on the island. And so being here on the 52nd anniversary, and I think that the elder veteran Eloy Martinez of the Ute tribe, he said it back, give us the title, that we are here, we are still here, we're practicing our cultural dances, our ceremonies, we are here in gatherings such as this, and that we want the title back to the island.
What is it going to take to make that happen?
I think it's going to take a lot of public effort and public pressure. In some of these land back campaigns, you know, what we've seen is the transfer into some of the do-gooder land trust options, you know, but these are essentially held in trust by non-Native peoples. And so I think that pushing for the effective management of Native people by Native people is what really needs to happen. And so the public pressure to ensure that if you think that you are a white-led land trust and that you're doing good by keeping a title of Native land in your hands and think that you're preparing the minimum stewardship that's needed for it, that there's still more work to be done, absolutely. And so supporting the local Native community in its land back efforts and supporting the original Alcatraz occupiers and our local relatives, our Ohlone relatives, in all of their efforts of land reclamation.
It has been, as was mentioned many times today, more than 50 years since this proposal for the cultural center was made. What are your thoughts about that it's taken this long for it to like come closer to fruition?
I was born 10 years after the initial Alcatraz occupation. I was born in 1979, and so for me it's been 42 years of a lifelong battle and lifelong dedication to being on the front lines, to fighting for Indigenous communities, to fighting for our Indigenous rights as Indigenous peoples. And so I think that it is really historic to, you know, as I shared earlier, to be able as a young child to learn from all of the occupiers, to learn from the students that were holding down the rock here, and that we still have so much more to learn, that the generations after us are still continuing to learn, you know, what the significance is and what the significance is in terms of Indigenous resistance movements and how Indigenous resistance movements are still continuing to this day. And so we have our relatives up in Winnemucca that are fighting at this time for protection of their homes, protection of their sacred places, fighting against lithium mines, fighting against uranium mines. And so, you know, we are here in solidarity with Indigenous peoples. We invite everyone to come out on November 25th at 4 a.m. to join us here on the Rock, where we will collectively hold the annual Sunrise Gathering.
If you're listening to this on Wednesday the 24th, you may actually still be able to attend this event. But it starts early. Boats for the ceremony leave every 15 minutes, starting at 4:15 a.m. You can find more information on the website of the International Indian Treaty Council, IITC.org. But as you may be listening after the fact, let me give you a bit of a sense of how it goes. Thousands of people turn out for these gatherings, showcasing songs, dance, and art from many different cultures. I went a few years ago for the 50th anniversary. Many of the people there were wearing pins or scarves or held signs with the letters MMIW, abbreviating Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. This is something that affects thousands of people. In 2016, more than 5,700 missing American Indian and Alaska Native women and girls were reported to the National Crime Information Center. But the U.S. Department of Justice's Federal Missing Persons Database only logged 116 cases. I spoke with one woman back in 2019 who brought a teepee to Alcatraz that travels all over California. It's painted with handprints of people who are searching for or mourning a missing or murdered relative.
My name is Sister Who Walks With Bears, but my colonized name is Marge Grow Eppard. We didn't realize there was so many missing and murdered Indigenous people. My own first cousin is missing since 1980. I was left for dead. So it hits so close to home. That's why I do this. And it's to bring awareness. And then when others come up and they tell me, my mother's been missing since 1950-something, it's like, oh my God, why isn't anything being done? It's because the authorities think we're out getting drunk or something. So bringing this awareness is vitally important now. And I know it's hard on a lot of families to bring the topic up, but when you go into this healing lodge that travels, the tears come. The healing starts, and then they get angry. I need to find my relative now. You know, we can't forget them, but that's what the government wants. They want us to be forgotten, and we're not going to do it.
Some of the speakers at the gathering brought dispatches from their own efforts. People from other movements showed up to express solidarity, including organizers from Standing Rock to Ireland, Palestine to Hawaii. And also quarterback Colin Kaepernick.
It's our responsibility to honor our ancestors and honor our elders by carrying on that struggle. Don't let their sacrifices be in vain.
Most of these events take place in the dark, starting at 4 in the morning. And then, slowly but surely, the sun starts to rise and the bay starts to wake up to the sound of prayers and music. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic. Civic comes to you from KSFP LP at 102.5 FM in San Francisco. Our theme music is by John Dillon. Our team includes producer and contributor Mel Baker and assistant producer Liana Wilcox. Civic airs Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. on KSFP. New episodes every Thursday.